Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And our guest today is a name that I bet many of you will already be familiar with. It's Tom Leatherberry, who is currently the director of the SMU First Amendment Clinic. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, good morning, guys. Happy to.
So, Tom, I bet a lot of our listeners already know who you are, but for those that don't, maybe those that don't know you that well, can you just kind of tell us a little bit about your background, maybe how you came into the law, that kind of thing?
Sure, happy to. I grew up in Fort Worth, so I'm a Texas native, went to Yale College and Yale Law School, and then moved back to Dallas to clerk for Federal District Judge Robert Hill, who was on the bench at that time. And, you know, I went into the law because it was the era of grim pre-professionalism, and you either went to business school or law school or medical school. And my seventh grade science teacher, Sharon Foster, discouraged me from going to medical school after a dissection in lab. And so law seemed like it. My sister was also a lawyer, my older sister. And so I had a little bit of experience with that in the family.
It sounds like there's more to that story about the dissection.
I was really bad. Ham-handed.
So
I never had a chance.
After you got done clerking, how'd you start your practice?
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to go to the Locke Purnell firm at the time, now Locke Ward. And really, that's where I started doing media law work, because the firm did at the time all of the work for, or most of the work at least, for the Dallas Morning News and Channel 8. And one of my first mentors was Steve Philbin, who really was the Dallas Morning News' lead lawyer. And I was in the office on a Saturday morning. I know that sounds very strange to younger lawyers listening to this podcast, but you actually did go in on Saturday mornings. You got mail at the office and you did a little FaceTime and then went to lunch with people. And that's kind of what we did. And Steve had just lost a venue hearing in a defamation case in Denton for the morning news. And he came bursting into my office on a Saturday morning and order at me and said, I need a brief. And that was back when you could appeal venue decisions all the way to the Texas Supreme Court. So I wrote a brief and was hooked. And he was a great teacher, he and John McElhaney and Warren Harrison. And that's how I got into media law. Then in 92, I moved to Vincent Elkins. I had actually clerked in the Fort Worth office of Vincent Elkins, which is now Kelly Hart, of course. In the summer of 1977, I split my summer between Fort Worth and Houston offices of V&E and was recruited to go there in 92 with a group from Locke, about six lawyers, and stayed at V&E until the end of last year.
So your practice, I know, has been a lot of appellate, but was it kind of divided between litigation and appeals? Did you know you wanted to do appellate work?
You know, I kind of gravitated over there. I mean, there really were not separate appellate sections when I got out of school. And so I did trial work, I did appellate work, and you handled your own appeals by and large. And so gradually I gravitated over towards doing almost all appellate work. Although with the media practice, you certainly appear in the trial courts quite a bit, particularly since 2011 with the Texas Citizens Participation Act. So I enjoy being in trial courts. I enjoy being in appellate courts. And I try in cases. I haven't helped try one in a long time. But when I do now, I focus on the legal issues, the jury charge, the limines, those sorts of things. I say I talk to the judge while the trial lawyers talk to the jury.
I was going to say, we've said that many times here on this podcast. And the TCPA aspect of all this is worth a little further discussion, I think, because I can only imagine that as a media lawyer, First Amendment lawyer, that really impacted your practice tremendously.
Yeah, there have been a couple of big changes during the course of my career in First Amendment media law. I mean, the first one was really driven by a big loss that we had at Locke. We represented Channel 8 in the Vic Fazell case in Waco, which resulted in a huge verdict and was ultimately resolved. And the feeling was that if we had been able to appeal the denial of our summary judgment, we would have gotten some relief and would not have had to go to trial on 11 separate broadcasts about then district attorney or former district attorney Fazell and his criminal troubles. And so in 93, Belo, which was the parent company of the Morning News at that time, worked with a number of different law firms, and the legislature passed the section of the interlocutory appeal statute that allows you to appeal denials of summary judgments in defamation cases. And that changed the practice quite a bit. And then obviously the TCPA, when it was passed in 2011, when it was amended in 2013 and amended again in 2019, has changed law practice quite a bit for those of us who do media defense or citizen defense in defamation cases and other cases involving the rights covered by the TCPA.
As a media lawyer, do you get involved on the legislative side when those types of statutes are coming up or being amended?
I've done a little bit, not much. The clinic has participated the last two sessions in a coalition. This session, it's called the Sunshine Coalition. It includes a number of public policy groups, from Texas Public Policy Foundation to the League of Women Voters to a number of media organizations. You know, we talk mostly about changes in Texas Public Information Act and the Open Meetings Act that the group would want to increase transparency in Texas. You know, Texas Public Information Act, when it was passed 50 years ago, as the Open Records Act, was really an outstanding example of governmental transparency. And now it's just a mess. It has so many exceptions and is so badly abused by municipalities and state agencies. The city of Dallas is one of the worst, absolute worst, in producing open records or in resisting production. So get a little bit involved in the legislative side. I'd love to see the thing I would love to see amended in the TCPA, but I don't think it's going to happen this session, it may, is to eliminate the requirement that attorney's fees be incurred in order to be recoverable under the TCPA, because so many people who are defendants in slap suits can't afford lawyers. And so the clinic, of course, does its work pro bono, and I've done a number of pro bono cases under the TCPA. But you can't collect fees. You might be able to collect sanctions and use your fees for a proxy for the sanctions. But thus far, under the construction the courts have given the fee provision under the TCPA, you can't recover them unless the client really owes you those fees.
Spend less time analyzing data and more time digging into the facts with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge. Powered by the largest collection of federal and state dockets, Litigation Analytics instantly aggregates data points to produce information such as likely timeline, outcomes, representation, and damages, from which you can base your case strategy and assess potential litigation costs and resources and position yourself for success. Gain a strategic edge using data-driven insights with Litigation Analytics on Westlaw Edge.
You have to incur the legal obligation to pay, as I remember.
Right.
So,
like the Medical Liability Act.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what it made me think of it too. Mm-hmm. It's the same. You're getting caught up in something that had nothing to do with the First Amendment, because there was all that was litigated under the medical expense recovery and personal injury cases.
Right.
And so that is unfortunate.
Yeah, you'd only have to eliminate one word, but sometimes cutting that last word from your brief hurts, you know, too.
Oh, so absolutely.
Absolutely. You know, go ahead.
Sorry, Jody. I mean, that is an interesting issue, especially, you know, we're going to get into talking about the clinic specifically, but, you know, those of us that our clients generally do incur our fees don't think about that as much, but you've got the clinic has a specific interest, and this applies to any number of pro bono type service providers, I would imagine. So that's an interesting issue to point out and consider.
We've mentioned the clinic a little bit, but let's kind of get a little bit more into that. How did the SMU First Amendment Clinic get started, and how did you get involved?
Sure. So I guess it was in winter of 2019-2020 that I got a call from Dean Collins at the law school, then Dean Collins, Jennifer Collins at SMU, and is a good friend. And her question to me was, would there be enough work to keep a First Amendment clinic busy at SMU? That was her main concern. She had been offered an operational, 5-year operational grant by the Stanton Foundation at Cambridge, Massachusetts. Stanton is the legacy foundation of Frank Stanton, who was the head of CBS News and very famous in the broadcasting and other industries. And Stanton has started actually 11 or 12 First Amendment clinics around the country. He was one of the more recent until they agreed to launch 2 more this year, one at Illinois and one at Nebraska. But Stanton had already funded Cornell, George Mason, Duke, Vanderbilt, Georgia. Tulane started the same year we did. Arizona State started the year before us. Wash U, Case Western. So the goal was really to train the next generation of First Amendment advocates and to make students more practice ready by giving them practical experience of working with clients and drafting pleadings and writing memos and writing briefs and working with experienced lawyers in the field. So when Dean Collins asked me, would there be enough work, I just started laughing and rolling on the floor because the clinic's informal tagline is Texas, so many First Amendment violations, so little time. And it's so true. I mean, if you look at the laws passed by the legislature over the past several sessions, you see incredibly unconstitutional laws like the Star Spangled Banner Protection Act, which compels us to listen to the Star Spangled Banner before every sports game played in a municipal venue or a venue with a city contract or state contract. You see the anti-boycott laws. They're very unconstitutional, compelling government contractors to pledge they won't boycott Israel during the term of their contract, compelling them to say they won't boycott fossil fuel companies during the terms of their contract. You see all sorts of constitutional legislation, particularly in the First Amendment area, coming out of our state legislature. So I told Dean Collins, I said, yeah, there would be absolutely enough work to stay busy. And she didn't call me to ask me to consider being the director, but I started thinking about it. And, it was getting to be a good time for me to think about a transition, and really has provided the perfect transition for me. It's very active. The clinic is extremely active. The students are great. And, I just really, really enjoy it. I did a lot of clinical work when I was at Yale Law School, and it meant all the difference to me in how I felt about law school and how I felt about my career, even though the type of law I did in my clinic at Yale has nothing to do with anything I really, work on now.
What kind of clinical work did you do?
Back then, states still had big state mental hospitals. And I worked in a clinic called Mental Hospital Legal Services, where we went up to the state hospital in Middletown, Connecticut. We represented individuals at civil commitment hearings. I even had a classmate who helped try a criminal case involving one of the patients at Connecticut Valley Hospital. Gradually, I kind of moved over into working in the children's unit on special education issues because the law had just changed and the big federal act had just been passed, which required individualized education plans for students with disabilities. And there was a lot of work to be done. So I appeared at school board meetings. I worked with families to try to get their children placed appropriately in either residential or non-resident settings. And, it really puts your law school neuroses in perspective because, you go to sleep worrying about footnote 4 in Caroline products and you realize, this is really silly to be worried about that. These people are our clients. We're dealing with real life-changing situations and you could have a real impact. So I think if our clinic can do just a little bit of that in the First Amendment area, it'll be a huge success.
So how do you structure it, I guess? How do you kind of find the cases and get the students involved in all that?
Sure. So SMU caps each of its 9 or 10 clinics at 8 students per semester. And then our students have the opportunity to return for a second semester if they want to. So we've had anywhere from 8 to this semester, we have 12 students, 8 in the clinic class, and then 4 returning students who are all really outstanding. You know, the cases come to us, some of them are referrals from people I've known, journalists I've known over the years around the country, or, you know, they come in all sorts of different ways. My fellow now, or the clinic's Peter Stephenson, spent 5 years before the clinic at Texas Civil Rights Project. So he has really deep ties in the civil rights community. And so we get some referrals that way too. And that's how we're working on one of our current cases. But, and then you assign students in teams, or sometimes one student to a matter, and you work with them and develop timelines just like you would for cases. Your answers due then, your special appearances due then, and move forward. And there's always a really good mix of counseling and litigation.
How many cases at a time do y'all have typically?
Oh, geez. we just went over Peter's great. He's so organized. We just went over our case tracker yesterday, and it just exhausted me. We probably have 20 active matters and others that are inactive right now, or they've reached a certain point where you've done what you can do and you're waiting for the client to come back to you on something else. So I'd say between 20 and 30 actually active matters. Again, a mix of litigation and counseling, not some appellate stuff that's one and done. Like, we filed 2 amicus briefs this semester already in the Fifth Circuit, one in the case that was argued in bank last week, Villarreal versus City of Laredo, about a journalist who was arrested for asking a police officer questions about a suicide, and then about a fatal traffic accident. And then we filed one last week in the Fifth Circuit supporting Eugene Volokh's effort to unseal a federal district judge in San Antonio had sealed entirely, and then unsealed it, and then sealed it again, went up on appeal. So that was a challenging brief for the students who worked on it, because we couldn't see anything. And so that's how the brief starts. This is a case about which we know next to nothing. It was a good exercise, though, and the students did a fabulous job. Our clients in the Villarreal versus City of Laredo case were 3 journalists, 2 of whom were actually currently representing in civil rights cases against the city of Dallas for their arrest or their detention during the George Floyd protests. And then in the sealed appellant versus sealed movement case, which is what the title is, the caption is, we represented Texas Public Radio from San Antonio, who's been a fabulous client for the clinic. We filed, one of the first lawsuits we filed was a suit under the federal FOIA for Texas Public Radio so they could get access to records showing the fraud and abuse that was going on in a COVID-related food program called Farmers to Families. Turned out that the successful bidder in San Antonio was a wedding planning company that didn't have licenses to transport food and was going to transport it in wedding limos and that sort of thing. So it's a fabulous job of reporting on that situation. And the wedding planner's contract was not renewed when it came up for renewal.
Wow. I want to come back to your fellow. You mentioned your fellow, Peter.
Stephenson, yeah.
Stephenson, is that a common thing for law school clinics to have fellows on staff? And what is their relationship to the clinic exactly?
Sure. Well, you know, we were fortunate because our funding included, you know, enough money to hire a fellow. I think most of the clinics that I know in the First Amendment area do have, some of them have more than one. Cornell is a bigger operation than we have. And there are couple of other clinics at SMU that have fellows. I know the Hunter Clinic, the Domestic Violence Victims Clinic, has a fellow as of this year. And they generally are fairly recent law graduates. You know, Peter's a 5-year lawyer, and my fellow before this, Michael Shapiro, was a 3-year lawyer when he started. And they go on and do various things after their term is up at the law school. I mean, Peter and I are talking about teaching another class maybe next semester or the semester after that in the First Amendment area, maybe some more tech overtones to it than we tackle now. Some of them go on to teach at other clinical programs. Some of them go on to direct clinics, and some of them migrate over to the doctrinal faculty, usually at another school. But so they do a variety of different things after it's over. They're also, I believe that SMU is going to make sure that they're all adjunct faculty members as well as fellows, so that we can make sure we meet all the ABA requirements about supervision of law students and the Texas Supreme Court's requirements for supervision of law students as associate members of the state bar.
Do y'all also work with co-counsel on your cases?
We do a lot. We have a case. We have, of course, Vince Elkins was really generous in working on a number of clinic cases pro bono. And I think it's great for the young lawyers at larger firms because they generally get more responsibility and take on a bigger slice of the puzzle in some pro bono cases than they're able to do in other high stakes litigation. But, you know, so we've worked with V&E on a defamation case or two that's now pending in the Texas Supreme Court, or that both of which are pending in the Texas Supreme Court. On an open records case for the Marshall Project, Carrie Blakinger, the reporter in Houston for the Marshall Project, who just left for the LA Times, was a good client of the clinic. We got a number of different records from the Harris County District Attorney for her. We have a really interesting case now for a Nigerian journalist activist who's been sued for defamation in Collin County by a pro se, also Nigerian American. And we're working on that with Jackson Walker. We've done some things with Haynes and Boone. I've had a number of different offers from other really generous lawyers who like to work with students. And, you know, we're always on the lookout for opportunities to co-counsel because it's great for the students to see other lawyer styles and to work on teams and see how other people get it done, as well as working with Peter and me. So, I mean, I think that's one thing that I hope people will understand, that, I mean, you may not have a First Amendment practice. You may have a family law practice, for example, or you may have a different kind of practice. There are clinics out there with students who need the work, who want to work, and they will do it pro bono. And whether it's an amicus brief to be written in one of your cases or representing a witness in one of your cases that doesn't have money to pay a lawyer, it can be a real help, I think, for people to leverage their practices. And one of the best experiences I think our students had over the first 2 years of the clinic was writing an amicus brief for Connie Pfeiffer at Yetter Coleman. She had a defamation case where a hospital was stuck for a $6 million verdict by a physician. And so we took on an amicus brief for a couple of health care organizations and were able to write the brief and watch the argument and help with a little bit of argument prep because of Connie's generosity, and then watch the argument and see her get the win. And it was really a good experience for the students to get kind of behind the scenes in depth in a case and feel like they made a difference.
When we talk about First Amendment, I mean, it really does have a wide breadth. What are some of the types of cases that y'all take on or have taken on?
So we kind of divide the cases into three different buckets. The first bucket would be core First Amendment cases. We were fortunate enough during the first year of the clinic to get a Fifth Circuit appointment in a Bivens case where a federal inmate alleged retaliation because he was exercising his right to petition and file grievances. And two students got to argue that before the Fifth Circuit by Zoom. Yeah, it was fabulous. And they did terrific. And so the core First Amendment cases, I mean, we also have the cases against the city of Dallas for wrongfully arresting or detaining journalists during the George Floyd protests. We're co-counsel with Texas Civil Rights Project in the constitutional challenge to the city's panhandling ordinance that went into effect recently. And then there are some defamation cases that do have, you know, really key First Amendment issues that are going to be dispositive. The second bucket would be cases where there are First Amendment issues, but they may not be dispositive. Some libel cases. We've represented the NAACP's Texas chapter and the League of Women Voters in the Crystal Mason case out of Fort Worth, where Ms. Mason was convicted of illegal voting when she cast a provisional ballot that was never counted in the 2016 election. So, there's a right to petition issue there, but it's not, may not be dispositive. This probably is not going to be dispositive where the case is now. The third bucket would be most of our open records and open meetings and those types of cases, whether it's advising on it, whether it's writing a letter to the Attorney General in a TPIA case, or whether it's actually filing a lawsuit to try and get records that have been wrongfully withheld. Those are usually related to journalism endeavors, but don't really expressly raise the First Amendment issues. So we've got all those types of cases and more, really, for journalists, for citizens, and for media companies. I guess we also do some, we also do some pre-broadcast and pre-publication review for a couple of clients. And, that's not going to expressly raise First Amendment issues, but it's sort of risk management and assessment of risk in stories and helping journalists say it, say what they want to say without taking on unnecessary risk.
Providing surety bonds for court-related matters is a very niche industry, and there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Court Surety Bond Agency. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA uses its more than 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds to provide first-class service to its clients. For more information, visit courtsurety.com.
What a sort of broad swath of cases that come in, and what a great opportunity for your students to work on really meaty legal issues that very important stage of their development. What's it like working with them? You mentioned your students who handled the Fifth Circuit argument and did well. Any other comments about working with the students?
Yeah, we mooted them three times for the Fifth Circuit argument, thanks to some faculty members at SMU and my colleagues at V&E. The students are really surprising sometimes because they see things with a fresh eye. And you've been practicing as long as I have been. You sometimes get a little stale and a little old, and you think you know what you're going to do and how you're going to approach things. And students will shake it up a little bit, and they've really done exceptional work. We've gotten some other students in court. They've argued summary judgment motions in Texas Public Information Act cases, and objections to evidence in TPIA cases and other things. And I think with the cases we have on the horizon, particularly the civil rights cases, they'll get more courtroom opportunities. And I really like to do that. It's been great working with students. It really has been. And they're engaged. The ones who come to the clinic, are very practice oriented. They want that practical experience. They want to hit the ground running when they reach their first employer. And it's a real pleasure to help them try and do that.
What's kind of your goal with the clinic? Is there something you're hoping to accomplish?
Well, I think the goals really are twofold. One is to educate students about the First Amendment, and hopefully, regardless of what they do in their legal careers, they'll understand First Amendment issues and how important the First Amendment is to every citizen's right to participate in government, to speak their minds, and then to give the students practical experience and to help them start faster when they hit their post-grad jobs. I think one thing Stanton really stresses is to make sure that students know that part of being a First Amendment lawyer is defending speech you hate. And the old saw about, I disagree with what you're saying, but I'll defend your right to say it. And I think that the First Amendment necessarily raises subjects that make some students uncomfortable. We've had discussions about the boycott laws in Texas, and for some students, that's not a comfortable discussion about whether the state can force government contractors to speak and that they won't boycott Israel during the course of their state contract. Some of the speech restrictions on abortion in the Texas abortion laws make students uncomfortable. And creating a comfortable atmosphere where uncomfortable subjects can be discussed is extremely important. I haven't gone as far to say this whole class is a trigger warning, but there's some days when I think I should, and some client materials that students have reviewed and come back and go, oh, but that's part of it. And you're not always going to like your clients and you're not always going to agree with your clients.
That's what I was thinking, is what a very valuable lesson for those students to get at this stage, to know that, you know, you do sort of just basically have to get comfortable with being uncomfortable. Even outside the First Amendment context, there's plenty of that you're going to see in your career that has nothing to do with working on a First Amendment case. So I think that's extremely valuable for them to learn and apply it to any context that they see in their career.
If we have some Texas lawyers that are listening out there that are either interested in maybe asking for your help or providing help to you, anything that people should know about reaching out to you either way? Like, are you looking for help? Are you looking to give help?
Well, I mean, unfortunately, we can't take on everything that comes our way. We just can't. We don't have the bandwidth. So I'm always looking, you know, for cases that are deserving and that we can't take on. I reach out to friends and see if they have the bandwidth to take them on and if they will take them on. Like I said, we love to partner with other law firms and with other lawyers and expose the students to how those lawyers work and how they put teams together and how they get stuff done and what their style is. I think that's very valuable. And we've been fortunate enough to, people have been very generous with their time. B&E was very generous with its resources and with its lawyers in helping the clinic get up and running. And it's been a great partnership and will continue to be one. And some of the other firms have too. So, and there's a little bit of trade-off that goes there too. I mean, people will, you know, friends who are First Amendment lawyers will call and say, hey, I just lost this case. We're going to take it up, you know, slot me in for an amicus brief in 3 months or, you know, whenever that happens. And so not bashful about calling them and say, well, hey, how about working on a case with us then? Because we're going to help you. And
yeah.
So a little tit for tat, as we all know, it's very comfortable. So, yeah, I mean, my SMU email works. It's thomasl@smu.edu. And that's probably the best way to reach me about getting involved with the clinic or helping the clinic or getting the clinic's help.
Well, it's been very exciting to follow what's going on with the clinic. You've been, certainly you've talked about it a lot, you know, on Twitter and elsewhere, I believe. So, but one of the things that I've always kind of wondered about is, you know, you've just recently retired from Vincent and Elkins, but you were doing both gigs for, it seems like, quite a while. How did you pull that off?
Well, probably not very well, Todd. Yeah, you know, we started the clinic's first year or first semester was fall of 2020. So we started during the middle of COVID in the hybrid teaching mode. And I mean, there was some overlap between my practice at B&E and the clinic and some pro bono cases that B&E allowed me to take on where the clinic was also involved. But it was busy and it's remained busy. I mean, it's good and busy at a healthy level, I think. If I could just sign all my, finish moving my stuff out of B&E and sign all the paperwork I need to sign, I'll be better. But that's my fault because I had 3 briefs due 1 week in December, 2 for the clinic and 1 for a B&E matter. And, you know, it's just, then the holidays came and I'll get it done. But yeah, it's been busy, but it's been good. And feel like certainly at the clinic, you do feel like you're giving back a little bit and like you're, it's a good thing to do. It was so meaningful to me when I was in law school. I'm still in touch with my mentors at the Yale clinic. And, you know, like I said, if I could just do a little bit of that for some students, that would be a big, big win for me.
When you started the clinic and you were just still obviously actively practicing at V&E, did you envision that you'd make that transition and leave V&E and go in full time with the clinic?
Well, not right away, I think. But, you know, I think it's always good to be thinking about. I mean, certainly it was in my mind as a possibility if I liked it. Timing was right. If, you know, it was as fulfilling as I hoped it would be, and it has been. And yeah, so I think it's always good to do things on your own terms and take control of what you can take control of and to plan what you can plan. And I feel like it worked out pretty well for me thus far.
You have a particular case that y'all have handled that's maybe the most satisfying one?
At the clinic?
Mm-hmm. Well, either one, at the clinic or in your
right.
practice.
Well, Yeah, I mean, some of the clinic cases are still ongoing, so I can't tell you whether they're ultimately going to be satisfying. But but it was certainly satisfying to have that initial win and get documents from the from the U.S. Department of Agriculture about the COVID-related food contract for Texas Public Radio. It's been really satisfying working with some clients who've published sensational pieces that we had a hand in pre-publication review and helping them get the information for the piece in the first place. So I don't think there's really been an unsatisfying case at the clinic. I mean, some of them can be frustrating when attorney general rules against you on an open records matter, and then you have to decide whether to sue or not and whether it's worth it to the client. The client has to decide whether it's worth it. But I think overall they've been very, very satisfying. I mean, in my private practice, there's certainly a couple of cases that stand out as cases that if I had been independently wealthy, I would have retired after winning, because it really isn't going to get much better than that. But kept on plugging away. The case that we've talked about representing CBS 60 Minutes in a jury trial in El Paso federal court, which was, gosh, 25 years ago now, was one of those sort of magical experiences that you never have, where the trial went flawlessly. It just couldn't have gone better. And certainly I would have retired if I could have at that point. After the jury sometimes the truth hurts. It was true, defamatory, and verdict for defendants. So
that had to be satisfying. I want to ask you specifically, first of all, I suppose maybe we should clarify that you, in addition to your responsibilities with the clinic, I mean, you have opened, I think, is it Thomas S. Leatherberry PLLC? I mean, you still are in active law practice. You haven't hung it up solely in favor of working for the clinic. But I thought that this would be a good time to ask you about another extremely significant case that you worked on that all lawyers in Texas, if they don't know about it, they must have been hiding under a rock, because it directly impacted their their livelihood. And that is what was originally styled, I believe, McDonald versus Sorrells, federal case filed here in Austin, heard by Judge Yackel or district judge here, and then eventually decided by the Fifth Circuit. Rather than have me talk about it, can you give us just a quick overview of the case and what the issues were? I mean, it dovetails right into the First Amendment discussion.
Yeah, it was a First Amendment case. And I would just say at the outset that, you know, it's all in the public record. Anything I'm going to say is in the public record, and you can see it. And it was an amazing experience to have 48 lawyers sued in their official capacities as your clients. That was a lot of cats to herd, but representing the State Bar Board was really incredibly satisfying experience. I've never felt more supported by clients and, you know, more understood really in terms of where the litigation was going and decisions that the board had to make and that sort of thing. So yeah, it was a First Amendment challenge to the State Bar Act. Three lawyers sued alleging that their compulsory dues were being used for activities they should not be used for, primarily speech-related activities, legislative activities, and that sort of thing. Their position was, in light of the Supreme Court's opinion in the Janus case, that compulsory bars were sort of the next thing on the chopping block after unions, and that compulsory dues could not be used to speak on matters that they disagreed with. So we did. Judge Yackel gave a summary judgment. Opponents on the other side, you know, just a terrific law firm of all former U.S. Supreme Court clerks, so easy to work with as opponents and so high quality. Jeff Harris and the late Will Consovoy, and you know, just couldn't say about the quality of their lawyering. Judge Yackel gave us summary judgment. We built a pretty fulsome record. I think it was, gosh, probably 700 pages or so of declarations and exhibits and so forth, because the plaintiffs challenged a number of programs of the state bar: the annual meeting, the bar journal, legislative activity, you name it, anything that really involved speech financed by by mandatory bar dues. The Fifth Circuit reversed in part and held that portions of the state bar's legislative program and the Access to Justice Commission's legislative program were not germane, the two ends served by the State Bar Act, and that's improving the quality of legal services and regulating the practice of law as a profession. And so those were not properly expended. The State Bar Board acted really quickly. Again, very proud of the work that they all did to amend certain portions of the policies and procedures and the state bar rules. They asked the court to make a couple of changes in some of the state bar rules. And by the end of the opinion came out right before 4th of July in 2021. I remember it was the Friday before 4th of July. And by the end of September, we had updated bar procedures and rules in place and were able to go to Judge Yackel and get the judgment entered. The plaintiffs did take it up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and it was held over a time or two. We cross-petitioned, alleging that speech by the state bar was government speech and therefore was not regulated under the First Amendment. And at the beginning of April, I believe, 2022, the Supreme Court denied cert in our case and in two other state bar cases that were up there at the same time. So I have nothing but admiration for the work the state bar does, the work that it does on behalf of lawyers in the state, and the advantages that they get lawyers in the state through the state bar. So I was happy to be part of the effort to save and to update the state bar of Texas.
Well, I think you undersell yourself a little bit there, Tom. I know you were the lead lawyer in the case. I know there was quite a team behind you. I know Vincent and Elkins provided a lot of valuable counsel with a lot of folks involved. As I remember, there was a permanent injunction that has a sort of regulatory aspect to it for the state bar. Like the bar, this is not a one and done situation where the case is like entirely over. Am I right?
Well, I mean, the final judgment was entered and I haven't looked at it in a while. But I mean, yeah, the state bar is under the obligation to operate within the limits set down by the Fifth Circuit as to what's germane and what's not germane. And so, yeah, I mean, there's ongoing oversight. I mean, the state bar has changed and made even more transparent a number of its processes, budgeting, legislative process, that sort of thing. So it has an ongoing effect, that's for sure. And the bar is very, very mindful what the Fifth Circuit holding was and what the judgment entered by Judge Yackel after the Fifth Circuit appeal requires.
And that cert denial, I'm sure, was quite satisfying.
Yeah, I had a sore finger for days after hitting refresh.
Kind of like bar results.
Box, go to this box, go to this box, go to this box.
Yeah. Right. Well, I'm
pretty sleepless night before that Monday.
Well, on behalf of the lawyers of the Texas Bar, you know, thank you for your work on that. Those of us that value, you know, having a mandatory bar association and the things that come along with that including the right to self-regulation, which is a huge aspect of this. So we're grateful for your work and always held yourself and carried yourself in a way that I think represented the bar well, based on my personal observation. So thank you for that. But now, as we get ready to close, as we talked about before we started recording, it's our tradition that we ask our guests to share a tip or a war story if they're able. And I happen to know that you've got one that I think is going to be pretty good. So I'm looking forward to hearing your war story, if you just.
Yeah, there's so many. You know, war stories are like First Amendment violations in Texas, so many in so little time. But yeah, I shared with you all one of the moments that made the defense of CBS 60 Minutes in El Paso and Judge Briones's court so memorable. And that was one of our key witnesses was a woman who ran the medical clinic closest to the slum-like neighborhoods, the Colonias, the plaintiff family owned and operated. And the woman who ran the clinic happened to be a nun, Roman Catholic nun, and a medical doctor. Her name was Sister Janet Gilday, and she's passed away now, but she was one of the loveliest women you would ever want to meet. And she was our last witness on a Friday afternoon before the jury went home for the weekend. And my former partner, law partner, Bill Sims, took her on direct, and he started in the strangest way. He said, "Now, Sister Janet, how would you get to Dairyland, the colonia owned by this family, if you were to leave the courthouse?" And she told him, she said, "You get on I-10 and you go east and you get to Asuncion and you get off at Asuncion." And he walked her through exactly how to get there and where they would go and this and the other. And we were all just shaking our heads and kind of going like, what? And there was a method to his madness, because there were TV reporters in the courtroom, and we walked back to the hotel after Sister Janet's utterly devastating testimony to the plaintiffs. And the TV reporters had all gone out there, and there hadn't been any local coverage of the slum-like conditions in these colonias until then, really. And it was all over the news that weekend. And so I guess my tip is, and we did win the case. Of course, you only talk about war stories where you win. And so my advice to the young lawyers out there is always have a non-medical doctor as your last witness on a Friday afternoon and get chummy with the TV reporters.
I love it. That's great. Well, Tom, thanks for spending time with us. We sure appreciate it. It's been enlightening, and we've certainly enjoyed talking with you.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure. And come see us at the clinic.
Will do.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.